In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Well, it seems like the question of the day is, does Joe Biden have dementia? Have you seen his economy? Because no sane person would look at what is happening and think that this economy is doing well, which explains why Joe Biden thinks the economy is doing great. Thank goodness we are told on a daily basis by the propaganda left-stream media just how great Bidenomics is, because things like evidence and reality might tell you otherwise. Although after Joe Biden's disastrous debate performance, the media is beginning to turn on him. It's not that they've suddenly just realized that Biden has some form of dementia. It's that he was so bad during that debate, they know they can no longer hide it or cover for him, like what they've been doing with the economy. So here are some stats for you, and we'll revisit these later on in the show with our guest. An honest media, the kind that used to hold truth to power, might want to report that there has been a huge uptick in business bankruptcy filings. In the first half of this year alone, 3,016 commercial Chapter 11 bankruptcies were filed. That is an increase of 34% from the same time last year. Small business bankruptcy filings rose by a whopping 61%. Personal bankruptcies are up 15% compared to last year. And then there's this. In just the first 5 months of 2024, nearly 2,600 stores closed. These are closures from big-name retailers like Macy's, Red Lobster, Walgreens, Family Dollar, and 99 cents only. And there are more on the way, as other major retailers have filed notices announcing that they are on the verge of bankruptcy. One of those is Big Lots, which recently announced that they have used up most of their cash on hand. Their stock is down 81% this year, and all of that combined, they say, raises substantial doubt about the company's ability to continue. Big Lots, Family Dollar, Dollar General, these are all low-budget discount stores. How bad is Bidenomics when people can't even afford to shop at discount stores? That $1 or $2 items are considered luxuries. At the current rate, 2024 could see 7,800 stores close. That would be an increase of 40% from last year. Well, thank Biden that things are going great, and the media that tells us so. Although, here's a little something for you to tuck away. Be on the lookout for the media to suddenly start hitting Biden with the truth about his own economy. That's when you know they have finally and fully turned against him. If they already want him to step down, that's how they apply real pressure. Because up until now, Joe Biden is believing their lies about his own economy. When they start telling him the truth, that could be what convinces him to step down, because nobody wins when you're in charge of a bad economy. Well, despite what the propagandist left-stream media might be telling you, things from where I sit don't look so rosy. But let's hear from an actual economist. I'd like to welcome back Jonathan Williams, who is the Executive Vice President of Policy and the Chief Economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. Jonathan, thanks for joining us again.
Always great to be with you, my friend. And I say greetings from the land of make-believe, as always in D.C. here, but it is a hot land of make-believe right now. And it's not just the hot air coming out of Washington, out of the White House and the Capitol building. It is actually over 100 degrees here for the last several days.
Yikes. And I'm sure all of that hot air from politicians doesn't exactly help either. So there you go. There is going to be an awful lot of bad news in our discussion today. We are, after all, talking about Bidenomics. So let's start, though, by talking about some potential bright spots. Alec, of course, focuses a lot on state economies and their economic outlooks. Other than the states who are always near the top, like Utah, is there one or maybe a few states that you can point to and say they have really had an awakening and that they are really starting to turn things around? And what did they decide to do differently?
Well, there's a lot of great optimistic stories. And Mark, you know, I'm an optimist. So it's hard to talk about the big bad things coming out of Washington, D.C. right now. But at the state level, we've seen so many great turnaround stories of states that were middle of the pack and now in the top 10 of rankings, like Indiana and North Carolina over the years. We've talked a lot about states like West Virginia and Kentucky and Ohio that have really gone from bottom wealthier states and rich states, poor states, to doing so many good things now that they're at least middle of the pack in the rankings and really improving from there, and actually starting to see population inflows for the first time in decades in some of these states. But then more recently, one of the interesting takeaways that we highlighted was, you know, it's not just red states. There are some blue states that are realizing, you know, there is economic reality after all. There is economics 101. You have to be competitive because you're competing ultimately against not just states around your borders, but states all across the country for businesses and for Americans as they look to vote with their feet and move across state lines. And so we highlighted a couple of states recently where we actually saw marginal income tax rate reductions in places like Connecticut, where it's a big Democrat majority in the legislature and a Democrat governor with Ned Lamont, who used to be this progressive, you remember him as the progressive challenger to Joe Lieberman
back in the day
for the United States Senate. Now he's actually somewhat of a centrist Democrat, and they're looking at making Connecticut more competitive through lowering income tax rates. And then the other one that was a real surprise for some is Hawaii. A state where there's only a handful of Republicans in the state Senate and just a few more in the state House, has been that way for a very long time with Democrat supermajorities. Hawaii has obviously been a high cost of living, high cost of doing business state. And just a number of weeks ago, we saw the Hawaii legislature and the governor sign the largest tax cuts in Hawaii history, both cutting income taxes and cutting other taxes across the board to really battle against this massive inflation and the cost of doing business and living on the islands. And so, I mean, there are some really great non-traditional takeaways here from states that had been doing very poorly in previous years from a policy and an economic perspective, and are now turning the direction and really moving in the right way here, both on a Republican state example and now a couple of really big blue states that have done it.
That is cool. I'm glad to see that they're finally facing reality there. And as you say, they're competing with those neighboring states, so they have to do something. As far as the economic outlook is concerned, you know, GDP was a paltry 1.3% in the first quarter. It was revised downward from 1.6. But business investment also slowed in the first quarter due to high interest rates. Prediction as of July 10th for second quarter is 2%, according to the Atlanta Fed. Blue chip consensus places it lower, under 2%. I've even seen another that predicted less than 1%. So do you have any reactions to those? Is that in line with what you'd be expecting?
Well, I think it's you have the scenario where we see the average American, hardworking Americans, you know, continuing to not get ahead, right? I mean, even as wages have gone up on a nominal basis, real wages have gone down during the Biden administration because of inflationary effects. And so you combine what kind of, I think, average Americans are feeling, and they're doing their kitchen table budgeting now with these broader, you know, macro numbers like the GDP numbers that you mentioned coming in really disappointingly in the earlier part of the year and revised downward, as you note. And then you look at the forecast from the Atlanta Fed that I watched fairly closely, and that was a big downward revision in their forecast as well, where I think at one point they were forecasting above 3% GDP growth in future quarters, and now those numbers all continue to come down. And so I think it's kind of a growing pessimism that we're kind of settling into this period where inflation is continually hard to tame. We're just this week, Jerome Powell, the Fed chairman, had said, you know, we may not even wait for inflation to get to 2% before cutting rates. That set equities markets sharply higher on a couple of the trading days. But that being said, I mean, I think there's a reality setting in that it's going to be very difficult to get inflation back down to a 2% norm with the Federal Reserve benchmark, all at the same time, while the economic growth numbers are coming in much lower than all of us would like to see. And I think, as you and I have talked about, Mark, in the past, one of the more concerning things of, like, you dissect the 1.3% GDP growth in the first quarter a little bit more, and some of my friends have done the numbers on this to show that they think it's about half of that 1.3% is coming from government-related spending and government-related transfer payments.
Yeah,
so when you look at the actual productive side of the economy, it's actually much worse than 1.3%.
Yes, I've often thought that we need to get government spending out of the GDP calculations, but anyway, that's a discussion for another time. Okay, time for a break. Coming up, we'll be looking at some of those job numbers. On Friday, some new numbers were released, but some old ones were revised and not in a good way. More with Jonathan Williams, Executive Vice President and Chief Economist of the American Legislative Exchange Council. And welcome back. We're talking with Jonathan Williams today. He is the Executive Vice President of Policy and Chief Economist at ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. That's ALEC.org. If you'd like to go visit their website, he's also the co-author of Rich States, Poor States. And today we're talking about the state of the economy under Joe Biden. And Jonathan, is it fair to say that the economy is in an abusive relationship with Joe Biden?
Well, yeah, I think that's not a bad way of putting it, but it is not a good relationship. Let's put it that way.
No, that's for sure.
This is something that, as bad as things are on some of these headline numbers, I think when the economy is, you know, looking at, and, you know, job creators, more importantly, is looking at what's happening in Washington with the threats of even worse policies and more regulation and even the threats of higher taxes. I think it's not just the current policy framework, but it's the expectations of the future. And that is not a good expectation if Joe Biden is continuing there with this regulatory and tax approach.
Yeah, sure is not. We'll get into that more later on here. But, you know, you mentioned headline numbers. And one of the biggest areas to look at in the economy, of course, is jobs and unemployment. And the headlines on Friday were that in June, they estimate 206,000 jobs were created, which beat initial estimates of 189,000. And while that might be good, we know that those numbers tend to be revised downward. And in fact, those allegedly good numbers were overshadowed by two major downward revisions from the two previous months. The month before, in May, jobs were revised downward by 54,000. And the month before that, April, was revised downward by 57,000. Together, that is 111,000 jobs that were just erased that never actually occurred. And that's more than half the jobs they just claimed were created in June. I mean, what do you make of those?
Well, it's a continuing problem, and you have to ask yourself, all of us have to ask ourselves the question of what are they going to do with this 206,000 number when the revisions come in next month, right? And so this is a continuing problem that we pointed out time and time again now for the last year plus for the jobs numbers and the GDP numbers, really, is there's this continuous approach of putting out numbers that are overly rosy and then always revising downwards, which is, we kind of get the gist here and get the, you know, the problem with that is, you know, the headline news reports, you know, things are, you know, not so bad seemingly in some cases. And then when nobody's looking at the corrections or on page 826 of the newspaper in a correction area, nobody's catching that it was actually way, way off. I mean, there's not many people that could be that far off career-wise and still have a job. But, you know, the government forecasters don't seem to have that burden.
Yeah. Well, as bad as it is to have 111,000 jobs erased that never actually existed, it gets worse because when you look closer, the jobs numbers were especially bad for manufacturing jobs. Zero manufacturing jobs were created in the month of May, and 8,000 manufacturing jobs were lost in June. These are the productive jobs which generate other jobs, not just no manufacturing job growth, but actually losing manufacturing jobs. I mean, that can't be good.
No, it certainly is not. And, you know, being a Michigan native and being in the heart of manufacturing part of the country, it's a huge problem for the upper Midwest and many, you know, areas across the country that are heavy with manufacturing. And when you look at, like my friends at the National Association of Manufacturers, you know, very concerned about some of the policies on tax front and others that are discouraging manufacturers from continuing to expand, this is, you know, just continued bad news on that front. But, you know, another element to kind of dig into on this jobs report piece, Mark, is that, you know, when you look at that 206,000 number that we talked about there, is, you know, that, you know, is not even keeping pace with what an economy should be doing just based on sheer population growth in the United States. These are not numbers. I mean, they seem big. They seem impressive. It's kind of the casual observer, but when they continue to be revised downward, and then you have the fact that the United States continues to grow in population, and a whole other argument whether folks are coming in the right way or the wrong way, and that's driven by birth rates or driven by illegal immigration across the border. Fact of the matter is, we need to be adding a whole lot more jobs to this economy if we're going to stay up just with population growth in this country.
When you say a whole lot more, what kind of target number would you want to see?
Well, I mean, you'd be looking in the magnitude of, you know, tens of thousands of more jobs every single month just to keep track of even close to the population. So it's something that's, you know, far off. It's something that's a real problem. But I think you get back to the fact of, you have a very uncertain policy environment. You have a very uncertain regulatory environment. You have so many of these agencies, Securities and Exchange Commission, the Federal Trade Commission, so many of them are out there kind of doing things to overregulate this economy and continue to make it harder to make these hires. And so we shouldn't be surprised when we see these numbers coming in, either being revised downwards or not being where they're at or where they should be when it comes to manufacturing or even keeping up with population.
So are you thinking we need to be closer to 300,000 per month?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. So as an economist, do you weight jobs differently? I mean, we're talking about manufacturing here, and I tend to think of those jobs as creating additional jobs because so much of what they do, you know, they're either making things that people are buying and they need to have the materials to make those things, so somebody else is making those, or they're making things that people need as part of their jobs versus like a service industry job, which includes things like restaurant workers and such. So do you weight jobs differently, or is it a job as a job as a job in terms of economic outlook?
Well, when you look at the, you know, obviously different levels of jobs reporting that we see out there, but when you look at certainly those jobs that have a effect throughout the economy, as you were mentioning, when a manufacturing job is created, there's lots more jobs downstream that are created to support those jobs, whether they're service industry, hospitality, or others. And yeah, I think you look at some clearly are going to be cyclical in nature, whether you look at travel and tourism in many cases will spike certainly at certain parts of the season. You have certainly the issue of temporary employment that comes in some of the reports. And so, yeah, you want to see the high paying quality jobs that actually have a downstream effect. They're going to support jobs throughout the economic environment throughout them. And so when you look at those numbers, like the manufacturing numbers, you look at even from small business job creation numbers. I mean, one of the things that we always talk about is that NFIB confidence survey. And while it's slightly up in June over the previous month, what you look at now, they are now 30th month in a row below the historical average of the NFIB confidence numbers. And so those, of course, the mom and pop shops, the stores that are anchoring Main Street America, who are the net new job creators across the United States, those are the ones that I pay special attention to as well and are very cognizant of the policy environment of personal income tax changes, things like that. These are ones that I think are especially concerning when you see the numbers from that NFIB confidence survey being so low for so long now, 30th month under average.
Wow. Okay, there is a reason jobs aren't being created, or the ones Biden claimed that had been created are being deleted, and it might have to do with rising bankruptcies and store closings. We'll talk about that next with Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council. We're talking about the economy today, taking a deep dive into what's happening as we like to do about once a quarter. I'm talking with Jonathan Williams, the American Legislative Exchange Council's Executive Vice President of Policy and their Chief Economist. Find out more about ALEC and the great work they do by heading to alec.org, A-L-E-C.org. And of course, we'll put that up on today's show page, which is 14-28 on iSpyRadio.com. So, Jonathan, I'm going to pepper you with some stats here, taking these from my opener. In the first half of this year, a total of 3,016 commercial Chapter 11 bankruptcies were filed. That is an increase of 34% from last year. It's even worse for small business. Bankruptcy filings for small business rose by 61%. And it's not just businesses. Personal bankruptcies rose by 15% compared to last year. And then we've got a whole bunch of stores closing in just the first 5 months of 2024. Nearly 2,600 stores closed, including from big names like Macy's, Red Lobster, Walgreens, Family Dollar, and 99 cents only. Even a few Walmarts had closed. At the current rate, 2024 could see 7,800 stores close. And if they hit that, that would be an increase of 40% more closures than last year. These are just beyond horrible.
Yeah, it's really difficult to put any positive spin on that. I'm sure the White House press secretary is working on it as she speaks. But, you know, this is something that's a problem. When it comes to, back again, you know, looking at Main Street America, right? I mean, these are storefronts all across the country that could be dotted with blighted buildings and abandoned storefronts. And, you know, you have to ask yourself the questions why, right? And you dig into some of these numbers that we see based on the surveys, you know, it's certainly borrowing costs with interest rates where they are a huge issue for business, small and large alike. You look at kind of the expectations of the future, right? I mean, they're looking at what customers may be willing to spend in the future, and whether these additional costs when it comes to employees, whether it comes to borrowing, whether it comes to property taxes, which has been a huge uptick across many parts of the country. You know, how do we keep sales high enough to make up for these new costs? And when you look at the NFIB survey, there is a net negative 25% score when those small businesses are polled on that they expect the economy to improve. So there's a huge negative feeling of small businesses in terms of their optimism on future economic conditions. And so you factor that in to say, all right, we anticipate sales may be down, their consumers going to be spending less in the future, they've spent down their savings, we're trying to figure out how to get employees, we have to pay them, you know, to more to even find the right employees, and then we can't make that up on sales when we have hard costs going up on property taxes and borrowing and so many of these other things. And I guess it's not really surprising to say you're going to see more businesses say, all right, enough is enough. We can't make this work. And it's really a sad story.
Well, earlier we were talking about manufacturing jobs and indicators. And I think another one is when you look at companies that specialize in like home renovation, you know, Home Depot and Lowe's and whatnot. Another one that is also on the verge of bankruptcy right now is Lumber Liquidators, although now I guess they've been renamed as LL. They've got 442 stores across 47 states, and to save money, you know, homeowners have always turned to do it yourself rather than hire out. But apparently, LL's sales have fallen as Americans who are struggling to make ends meet have been forced to cut back on renovating their own homes. I mean, here's another one that just would seem to be a really strong indicator that things are just not going nearly so well as the left-stream media propagandists would have us believe.
Well, and you look at the overall, this is pretty consistent probably with the numbers that I've been seeing, and I'm sure all of us have been seeing coming out of the pandemic, as Americans had, you know, spent down a lot of the accumulated savings in many cases, right? And so you had that aggregate savings number continue to go down, where, you know, people don't have that extra funds to be able to put towards a large project. I mean, just seeing some of the shockingly high numbers of the percentage of Americans that live paycheck to paycheck, let alone have enough money sitting around to do major home improvements, I think just speaks to the overall issue back in where we started of, you know, yeah, we look at all these macro numbers on GDP and job creation and things like that, but what is the average American doing? Why is it that small business confidence is low? Why is it that people don't have the savings? Why is it their take-home pay is lower than it was at the start of the Biden administration? When you look at the net effects of inflation, you combine all of that together, and I think you get into a scenario why you're seeing some of these decisions by even these retailers like we've been talking about here.
Well, according to the American Bankruptcy Institute, the increased bankruptcy filings come as businesses struggle in an environment of high costs, especially so with rising labor costs and high interest rates. And on the interest rate side, the Fed has kept rates between 5.25% and 5.5% since last July, which certainly helps banks to make money, but businesses not so much. Fed policymakers said in their June meeting that they have no plans to cut rates until they have greater confidence that inflation is heading closer to that target of 2%. You know, we just talked about businesses struggling in part because of high interest rates, but correct me if I'm wrong here, but it seems to me that keeping the rates high is kind of the financial equivalent of not just watching room burn, but of refusing to put it out, the fires. Wouldn't an interest rate cut allow some of these companies on the verge of bankruptcy to refinance before things get out of hand? I mean, it seems like they have an opportunity to help here, but the Fed is choosing not to. So why aren't they?
Yeah, it's, I mean, it would be an economic lifeline for many of these companies that are on the ropes there if rates go down. There's no doubt about that, to refinance and to actually make things work and to keep people employed and keep their storefronts, right? So that is a major, you know, issue. Now, why doesn't it happen? To answer that question is, you know, this is the delicate dance because of really the consequences of the Bidenomics and overspending, right? The Fed is put in this nearly impossible position of how do you control this inflation that's burning far too high, that has reduced people's take-home pay, as we've been talking about, while not killing the businesses that are relying on lower borrowing costs through these, and not to mention homeowners, housing costs all across the country. Mm-hmm. I mentioned property taxes a minute ago, but when you look at the standard 30-year fixed mortgage continuing to be stubbornly above 7% for people with good credit, this is a huge problem, not just for businesses, but for individuals. And of course, this is the ultimate cost of overspending and the yes. policies of adding trillions upon trillions of dollars of federal spending and federal debt during the pandemic. And more importantly, and the more damaging policy mistake was continuing the spigots wide open
yes.
Past pandemic and
yep.
continuing those government spending programs.
Yep. Didn't occur to them at all. It seems to maybe rein that in a little bit. So actually, let's talk about that next. What if Biden wins? Stay with us. More with Jonathan Williams. And welcome back. This is the Ask Byron Radio Show. We're talking today about Bidenomics, and we're doing that with Jonathan Williams. He is the Executive Vice President of Policy and the Chief Economist at ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. And Jonathan, you know, we absolutely dread the thought of Biden winning, but we are seeing signs already of potential cheating out there in terms of the elections. I came across this just today. In fact, there have been tens of thousands of new registrations via Social Security/Medicaid. Thanks to a loophole in Obamacare that automatically sends voter registration forms to anyone who applies for Medicaid. In a state like Arizona, they had a net weekly new registration of 37,000 per week. And over a year, 52 weeks, that's new voters totaling 1.9 million in a state that only has 7.4 million residents, according to the 2023 census estimates. So pretty worrisome there. I need to explore that some more, but just on the surface, that seems rather worrying. And even more so, Pennsylvania had 90,000 new registrations. So if Biden wins, he has pledged to let the Trump tax cuts expire. So if those go away, what does that look like?
Well, if everything that we've been talking about is bad already, the Trump tax cuts going away makes it a whole lot worse because then it adds trillions of dollars of tax increases over time of problems and disincentives for businesses to stay open and expand and keep those people hired and pay good wages. It takes all those incentives away and actually makes it much more expensive to do that. And, you know, one of the most egregious things of this whole discussion is who is this going to impact? It's going to impact all taxpayers across sure. the country, all individuals, all small businesses who pay individual side tax on the income tax. And this is something that is going to not only affect, you know, the so-called millionaires and billionaires that Nancy Pelosi claimed were the big recipients of these tax cuts. It actually, we saw the tax code move in the direction of the wealthy paying more because they were making more after the Trump tax cuts and the economy did so well. And so we saw actually receipts come in higher. And then also we saw things like the child care tax credits and some of the other elements of the Trump tax cuts that helped working families and parents make ends meet, that we would see a massive tax increase, not just for the high end of the income spectrum, but for every income taxpayer across the country is going to be paying more. And this is just something that is a massive shooting ourselves in the foot when it comes to this discussion around the American economy. And the real interesting thing about this, Mark, is you saw the press secretary was asked about this and that it didn't the president plan or pledge not to raise taxes on anybody earning less than $400,000 a year. And she said, well, yes, and he's not going to. And then the reporter followed up and said, but you're going to allow this tax cut to expire. And she's like, yes, of course we are. And so they're put in this very difficult spot wow. in that they're going to be raising taxes in a major way on individuals all across the country. And yet saying they're not going to raise taxes on anybody making under $400,000. I don't think the average American is going to buy this. This is, you know, typical Washington weasel words
yes.
and Washington speak around tax policy.
Absolutely. Yeah. They excel at weasel words. In your op-ed for the Daily Caller in early June, you said that calls for higher taxes are a pillar of President Joe Biden's reelection campaign as he pledges to allow the popular Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, that's the Trump tax cuts of 2017, to expire at the end of 2025. It's amazing to think that anyone, even someone with dementia, would think more taxes, especially in this economy, would be a good thing. But besides the Trump tax cuts going away, Are there other taxes he wants to raise?
Well, I mean, there's a lot that he's talked about. I mean, there's even discussion around raising the business income taxes around the United States. Mm-hmm. That was actually one of the things that's not going to be scheduled to go away on the phase out, like we're talking about with the individual side. But there's a discussion after President Trump got the U.S. back to the average, basically, around the world after the Trump tax cuts, after the U.S. was one of the highest tax countries for U.S.-based businesses. You know, a lot of people forget there were trillions of dollars of profits that were brought back into the United States to come work and grow jobs here in the United States after those tax cuts. And I've heard discussions around Washington, some from the White House and some from members of Congress, saying we need to go back and raise the price of doing business in the United States. Wow. You know, you remember, Mark, for like a decade or two, we had this problem of these inversions of U.S. companies going to become European companies for no other reason than the tax law was better and they would pay lower taxes. We got rid of that. We brought trillions of dollars more back to the United States after the Trump tax cuts. And this is what some people in Washington would like to backtrack on and actually make America less competitive.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that is a horrible idea, because nothing is worse when you punish people or businesses for being successful. America has survived worse economies. America tends to be pretty resilient. But if Biden wins, I honestly think that he and the Democrats would double down on their economic policies as somehow vindication that the American people want more of it. What would more Bidenomics do to America after another 4 years?
Oh, well, you know, God forbid, this could be very, very ugly for so many elements of the economy that we've been talking about. I mean, if you like inflation eating away at your real wages, if you like seeing these anemic GDP numbers and job growth numbers, and then all of a sudden a potential second term is looking at, you know, continuing to double down on the policies of failure when it comes to the economy, who knows how high we could see some of these numbers go in a negative direction. I think that's just kind of sends chills down the spine of anybody that's been following this for very long at all.
Well, it is rather horrifying to think that Biden could win, or another Democrat, because we know that they would just continue many of Biden's policies there. But however, let's look on the bright side. What if Trump wins? We will do that next with Jonathan Williams of Alex. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking about Bidenomics today. We're doing that with Jonathan Williams, who is the Executive Vice President of Policy and the Chief Economist at American Legislative Exchange Council. Their website is alec.org. alec.org, and you should also check out richstatespoorstates.org, or is that .com?
.org, yeah, you're right.
Okay, that's what I thought. So yeah, richstatespoorstates.org. We'll put links to both of those on today's show page, which is 14-28 on iSpyRadio.com. And so, Jonathan, I think things are looking, putting aside Democrats stealing the election with fraudulent voters, things are looking very positive right now for Trump to win re-election. And it could be that Democrats may want to let that happen because, you know, he could turn things around, turn the economy around, and then they can come in and abuse it later on, and the American taxpayers, after he's got us back on track. But let's talk about Trump here in terms of things that he could do to get us back on track. What should be some of his top priorities at this point, you think?
Well, I think, you know, almost job number one when it comes to taxes in the economy are to do exactly the reverse of what a President Biden 2.0 would do, and that is actually look to make the Trump tax cuts permanent and make sure you continue to make progress on the business side and help just with those business confidence issues that we've been talking about. I think you need to also, you know, look at things like deregulation. This is something that, you know, the Trump administration made so much progress on, the 2-to-1 rule that turned into, you know, at some points with administration, maybe 10 or 16 to one of regulations repealed for every new regulation proposed. So my good friends were working on that at OIRA and some of the other federal agencies. And that's an incredibly important thing that doesn't get nearly enough attention, doesn't get enough attention compared to taxes or other big economic policies, but such an economic boon for United States, especially, you know, in the light of the Chevron decision recently from the United States Supreme Court, that is going to let's all hope that members of Congress and legislative branch will now write laws that are more craftily and carefully created so that we actually can have things done by the legislative branch, the people's branch, and have real accountability versus unelected bureaucrats interpreting, where the legislative branch kind of leaves those things to interpretation. And so I think a deregulation agenda 2.0 for the Trump administration would be big. And then, you know, one of the biggest things that we're going to hearing talked about at the convention here in the platform, as I understand, is a really top line item, is education freedom. This is something that has been just sweeping the nation. Alec is really pleased to be leadership of that, with our members leading the way in so many of the states, and our Education Freedom Alliance that we helped create with several other groups, Governor Doug Ducey of Arizona, Governor Kim Reynolds are co-chairs of that group. We do it with the Job Creators Network and our good friend Steve Warrick, Committee to Unleash Prosperity. We're seeing 12 states now become universal school choice states. And now the federal government, I think the Trump administration could really make it, double it down on that and say, let's push more education back to the state and local level, and let's get this horrible bureaucracy, the Department of Education, called eliminated, right? I mean, altogether, this is what the Reagan platform called for. And I think getting that federal bureaucracy out of states, doing the right thing, and more importantly, out of the lives of families trying to do the right thing for their kids, could be an absolute game changer. You add that to an economic agenda and deregulatory agenda, and that would be an absolute home run for a second Trump administration. We get a lot of other great things, obviously, to get as well, but I think top tier, in my mind, those would be the top items.
Well, sadly, school choice died here in Oregon, at least for this year. They needed to get two ballot initiatives on, and they just failed to get enough signatures. So hopefully they'll come back at it better next time. We were talking earlier about Biden, and just to really get people in a snapshot of the differences between a Biden administration versus a potential Trump administration. Recently, Biden's Department of Interior shut down 28 million acres of federal land in Alaska from any oil or gas development or mining. And this is 28 million acres. That's the size of Pennsylvania, according to the spokesman. And then also, Biden's interior had blocked a 200-mile gravel road that would have connected mining districts in west central Alaska to a highway that runs through the middle of the state. Those mines and those mining areas are rich in copper and cobalt, but Biden and far-left bureaucrats are shooting themselves in the foot because copper and cobalt, of course, are needed for their so-called green energy transition. Trump had actually already approved the permit for that road back in 2020, but after Joe Biden was elected, the Interior Secretary canceled that and said that Trump's administration studies had been, quote unquote, inadequate. And you're talking about regulations and stuff. This is a road that has been on the books for 44 years and still has not been done.
I mean, it's kind of the definition of cognitive dissonance, right? In that, you know, we have the kind of the rhetoric coming out of the Biden administration, you know, talking about how, yes, we're for all the above, and we're, you know, for, you know, all these oil and gas projects going forward. The reality, of course, is that many of these things were permitted under the Trump administration when there was record permitting. And now the Biden administration has just, you know, been able to take credit for so many of these projects that have continued. And then, you know, the point that you made is they canceled a lot of the permitting that had been done towards the end of the Trump administration as well. And so, yeah, for those that, you know, want to do this transition, obviously is not possible to do unless we have real capacity in the United States and the mining and refining of these rare earth minerals and others that would potentially, you know, make it happen. Otherwise, we're going to be beholden to China and other areas around the world that we're having some real problems when it comes to child labor, slave labor, all the things that happen in some of these areas that we would be relying upon, which we just cannot in a good moral conscience be relying on those type of things.
Well, here's a fun fact. I don't know if I've ever mentioned it with you. I know I've mentioned it previously on the show, is that for every, you know, we talk about this green energy and all this nonsense. It's not green because in the process of mining and refining rare earth minerals and some of the other metals and whatnot that they need for green energy, for every one ton of that is mined and refined, it generates 2,000 tons of toxic waste, much of it radioactive. So to call this green, it's just not simply green.
But, and also, I mean, it's a good point. And then, you know, just beyond that, as I mentioned, I mean, are we okay as a society if we're not going to develop it in the United States? I mean, that's a big decision whether you have that and you have the toxicity and all the issues that you're talking about there on mining it. here potentially, but then as a society, and we can't be okay having child and slave labor do this to make part of this, you know, transition to the so-called green economy, as President Biden would talk about. I mean, that puts us in a very difficult position, and it kind of just highlights the feasibility problems of ever making this happen short term.
Yeah. Okay, it is time for a break. If there is a dumb economic idea, Oregon wants to try it. We'll talk about that and wrap things up with Jonathan Williams of ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council. Stay with us. And welcome back in our final segment now here on the iSpy Radio Show. We've been talking with Jonathan Williams of ALEC. He is their Executive Vice President of Policy and also their Chief Economist. And I've been talking a lot about Bidenomics, and I teased in that last out there that if there's a dumb economic idea that Oregon would want to try it. And case in point, the Oregon Catalyst, this is from a write-up that I had about this, Initiative Petition 17 has turned in 130,000 signatures to be verified so they can qualify for the November ballot. This petition would greatly spike the corporate minimum tax on corporations. It would hit corporations that have over $25 million in sales and would levy a minimum tax rate at a new 3% tax. And that is a tax on sales, not on profit, which means that taxes it would tax companies that aren't making any profits nonetheless. And so the goal of this is to take the revenue generated from that and to hand every Oregonian, regardless of age, or even whether or not you're a legal citizen here, $750 per year. So I can't imagine this is a good economic idea.
Well, yeah, it doubles down on bad economic ideas for a state that's known for it. As you just mentioned, a state that is economically, you know, rated in our economic outlook for rich states, poor states, already at 42nd out of the 50 states, from bottom 10 for, you know, many years running here, and taking that and just expanding on the high tax burden. I mean, coming up with this kind of utopian sounding idea of universal basic income, more or less, is kind of taking this progressive wish list of things. And, you know, even taking out the practicality issues of how you're going to get these checks to, you know, infants and small children, and kind of that whole issue, or the issue of non, you know, people that have not been really residents of Oregon and have just been there. Maybe they're homeless. Maybe they don't have an address. Maybe they're not even legal citizens of the United States. I mean, these are all very big practical questions that I think supporters of this idea need to answer. But then you look at the devastating effects that something like this would have on businesses. I mean, they, you know, claim this is going to just be for mega corporations. And you pointed out, it's only, you know, $25 million of sales where you would qualify for this. Maybe to hit the discriminatory tax if you haven't hit this, you know, arbitrary 3% target. Now, the 3% sounds really low, but, you know, this is already what, on top of the corporate income tax and all the other things, is kind of the 3% of total receipts. And so that is a massive kind of a tax on gross receipts if it would be a minimum 3%. You know, a lot of these other states that have gross receipts taxes, many got rid of theirs because they're not a very good economic idea in the first place. But those rates are, you know, sometimes under 1%, sometimes just over 1%. But to say that it would be 3%, it would be a massive problem for Oregon competitiveness. And you know, I think it's safe to say that you would see a additional huge migration of businesses out of state over time as this potentially would be put into effect.
Well, and of course, we know that it will never stop there if they manage to get this through, because it's $750 now, and you can see them wanting to raise it to $1,000, and then the year after that it's $1,500, and on it can go. And just so people know, $25 million in sales at 3%, that's a tax of $750,000. So you can, and if you're barely getting by as it is because you're working on narrow margins, to suddenly add $750,000 in taxes, that's going to drive, like you say, it's going to drive people out.
Well, and it's also something we've seen happen in other states. My home state of Michigan had one of these, and they repealed it and went to a more of a traditional income-based tax for corporations versus this gross receipt style tax. Because, you know, to oversimplify for the minute of risk of just sounding too elementary here, the difference between net and gross is awfully important when you look at a $25 million threshold. So you could have a scenario where you have $25 million sales, as you pointed out, but you have next to no profitability in some years, right? Because you have lots of these wild swings in costs and borrowing costs and things like that that we've been talking about. And let's say you make no money or next to nothing on $25 million of sales, you still owe, under this scenario, yes, a $750,000 tax bill. And so that's the kind of thing that puts businesses completely into a bankruptcy scenario if they don't have the cash flow and they can't get borrowing to cover that. This is something that puts businesses down and out. We saw it in Michigan, and that's exactly why the Michigan legislature came in and said, no, we can't do this and hit unprofitable businesses with a huge tax bill, regardless of what's going on with their ability to actually cover those taxes.
I know that some cities have tried these. I think some counties may have as well. Has basic income schemes worked anywhere?
I mean, there's some small test cases that we're seeing in some of the progressive cities now to begin to talk through this. But long term, I mean, I don't think it's viable whatsoever. The point that you made is a good one. It's a slippery slope very quickly from $750 a year to saying, well, costs are going up and the inflation is up, so let's raise this to $2,000 a year. And then what does that mean in terms of additional costs for those that are actually producing? I mean, when you get to a spot where you have so many people receiving and then a limited number of people producing in an economy, that's where you get into some real problems. I mean, this is back to kind of the heart of the fatal conceit of socialism, is you run out of people that are producing pretty soon because you've driven them all away. And especially in a state level, to do this is absolute economic malpractice because it's going to drive those job creators out of state. I mean, the proponents of this initiative literally laugh at that and say it's ridiculous to suggest that business owners will leave because of higher costs. Well, look at California. Look at the past in Oregon and how many businesses have already left because of high costs. And you add fuel to that fire, and I think you come up with really economic devastating conditions for the future of Oregon if this passes.
Yeah, it's a shock. So anyway, dumb ideas are born here in Oregon, unfortunately. Jonathan, well, thank you so much for your time today.
Always great to join you, my friend.
Something we did not get into with Jonathan regarding those jobs numbers, because it's a little bit into the weeds, the recent jobs report, which had an increase of unemployment to 4.1%, has triggered what is known as the SAHM rule. That's S-A-H-M for those who want to look it up. According to the SAHM rule, a recession is underway if the three-month moving average of the national unemployment rate rises by 0.5% or more relative to its low during the previous 12 months. That 12-month low was a year ago, July 2023, at 3.5. With that increase last month, the average for the last 3 months is 4.0. So take that as you will. We all pray that Joe Biden is not reelected, but it can't just be prayers. Prayers need boots on the ground and people to be involved. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.